Good afternoon. Thank you for joining At the Root of It. This is Erin Fitzpatrick, broadcasting on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn. It is the 26th of January, and we're broadcasting live today and every Tuesday at 4 p.m. We'll start today's show with the Week in Wine recap and latest news. New York Governor Patterson has resumed the political debate over allowing wine sales in New York State's 19,000 supermarkets, grocery, and convenience stores. Patterson has asked the legislature to permit sales of wine in these stores to alleviate a $7.4 billion budget deficit in 2010 to 2011. Opponents of the proposed claim that the NOR law would heavily impact on the state's 2,745 liquor shops, predicting that 1,000 liquor shops would close. By way of concession, the governor is proposing to allow liquor stores to own multiple stores and let them sell wine to restaurants and bars. We will see what my guest today, Karen Auth of Tintofino Wine Store, has to say about this. Currently, 35 of the 50 states allow supermarket wine sales. And in the crop report, Jancis Robinson has released her 2008 report of Burgundy vintage, entitling it a question as whether or not the Burgundy 2008 vintage was a miracle. She goes on to describe the mixed weather of 2008 growing season, which began with poor fruit set on many of the grapevines. Battle with mildew, hailstorms, and rot rampaged the vineyards during intense periods of rain. And just when all seemed to be lost, the sun came out in mid-September and shone for one entire month so that the good grapes that were left on the vine turned out to be great. Vintners are calling the 08 vintage a miracle, and Jancis claims that the best domains were certainly better than expected, with high acid levels but enough flesh to compensate in the best wines, as low as production levels may be. And lastly, in the market feed, mpnnow.com reports that wine sales are up for the 16th straight year in a row. 2009 marked a 1.5% increase with 176 million cases sold compared with 205 million in the year 2000. It further notes wine sales have shifted from on-premise to retail stores as consumers increasingly choose to dine in, and that direct sales to consumers at tasting rooms or through wine clubs and the internet are gaining in popularity. And that wraps up the Week in Wine. We will be back after this short break with my guest this afternoon, Spanish wine guru Karen Auth. Welcome back to At the Root of It. Thank you to our producer, Jack Inslee, and engineer, Nat Wainan, for today's show, as well as to our sponsor, Whole Foods Market. And for listeners who are joining us, please call in with any questions for my guest today at 718-497-2128. So, a welcome to Karen Auth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Erin.
And for those who have not had the pleasure of meeting Karen or hearing her speak, Karen is a partner in Tintofino. And just wanted to introduce Karen and also have her speak about the store and your latest opinion, or if you have an opinion, regarding the news that I just reported about Patterson's debate over wine sales in New York State's supermarket and grocery stores.
Well, thank you, Erin. I think as far as the ability to sell wine in whole supermarkets and whatnot is something really interesting, especially for an establishment like Tinto Fino, being such a small neighborhood local store, particularly being more in a, on a boutique level, considering that we, you know, we focus and exclusively represent the wines of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, I mean, yes, I think it could take an impact. However, in saying that, I do believe that it depends on the store. For example, yeah. I mean, I'm just a few blocks away from Whole Foods, and there was that big debate not too long ago where they were about to, where they have now the beer area.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking mm-hmm. of Whole Foods,
sure, yeah, a good beer selection they have. I have to say,
I shop there quite often. Mm-hmm. I have to say, local, great beer selection. But that was about to be a wine store. That was what mm-hmm. that was originally supposed to be, and it's 4 blocks from my shop. And Whole Foods has a tremendous amount of power, and their selections are great. I miss their Columbus store circle as well, but. I think, you know, you have a little boutique store like that, like Tinto Fino, and then something like Whole Foods where you have knowledgeable people. The overall supermarket.
Yeah, and convenience store.
Convenience store, yeah. Local bodega, things like that. I don't think would affect my particular business and some of the real boutique or local stores too much, just due to the plain fact of knowledge and service, especially what you were saying earlier, people are spending a little bit more of their money in retail stores, as opposed to restaurants. Well, they're doing that because they want to eat delicious food that they can control, you know, what they're eating, the product, where it comes from, how it's prepared, and they want to be able to match it with a delicious wine that's going to complete the experience. And I think it's very difficult to enter into some supermarket bodega and get that type of that type of knowledge and that type of service that you can get in a more unique or more boutique store.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So you find, I mean, I think probably also, like you mentioned, location-wise is important, because before you get to Whole Foods, which is still 3 or 4 blocks from Tinto Fino, which is on First Avenue between...
It's 85 First Avenue between 5th and 6th.
5th and 6th, okay. You know, there's also a Key Food, right? Right next door, I think, one block down. So yep,
4th and A.
Yeah, when you think about convenience or maybe lower quality grocery stores that mark the landscape of New York, you think about these other ones that pop up there. And it is about convenience when you're buying wine or, you know, liquor or beer. So trekking that extra mile or, you know, so a half a mile to a store such as Whole Foods, if you don't live a couple blocks from it, it's harder to imagine going to somewhere like Key Food if you live right down the street from that and buying your wine there.
It's true. The only opposition to something like that is, again, what we were speaking about before is, like, you know, the amount of people on hand, with all due respect, and maybe this will change, and maybe in Manhattan it's not as vital as it might be, say, in Westchester,
mm-hmm.
where you do have a Whole Foods or a large supermarket where you have to drive, you know, 5 miles or whatever it is to the local wine store and make it like a 3-stop shopping. Whereas with something like Key Food, I mean, a lot of people, wine is important. And, you know, if you don't know about it or it's a price issue, there's lots of different consumers. And I think the majority of the consumers that would go to a store like Whole Foods or a store that's a little bit more like Commodities, which is a great East Village whole food market,
right,
would be wonderful, and they would be more likely to come to Tinto Fino as opposed to buying their wine at a supermarket like Key Food.
Mm-hmm. So as the current debate kind of enlivens further, would you be in a position to vote on it?
Erin. we receive all of the notifications from the SLA and everything that they're discussing as far as all of these bills coming up. And I mean, of course, we would fight for the small business. I mean, mm-hmm. that's what makes our particular neighborhood. I was mentioning to Erin before how much I just adore and love the East Village where Tinto Fino is located due to its incredible concentration of small,
mm-hmm.
amazing, very specialty, very delicious, very local and community-based businesses. And I would, you know, fight to the end to support that. So
It is a unique place in the city, I have to say. East Village really rocks in that.
It's true. I mean, we're not too far from some of the best food, wine, and, you know, atmosphere destinations in the city. Just 7th Street alone with all of its great places. Porchetta, Abrazo Coffee, Pilos, delicious Greek food, Butter Lane Coffee Shop. I mean, cupcakes and lobster rolls at Luke's, Caracas Arepas Bar.
It's just food row there. Yeah.
Food row in the East Village. And it's expanding. It's a beautiful community. It's a great place. I feel super attached to it, and it's quite. And I feel that the clientele that we're building there, along with all those other businesses, is loyal. Is honestly loyal, and they appreciate that extra little bit of service and connection to the place that they're spending their money, especially in these kind of economic turmoil times. I think that people want to know that their money, where it's going.
Sure.
And so when they walk into the store and they see, you know, me and the staff there and talked about, you know, what we had for dinner last night and what the great pairing was and what the new one is.
Yeah.
It's people like that. Mm-hmm. It's important. Mm-hmm.
So given, going back to your store, you're solely Spanish.
It's an all Spanish wine shop. Yeah. Yep. Vinos de España.
And when did it open?
It opened in October of 2006.
Okay. And you joined in?
I joined in this past January. It was my 1 year anniversary on January 2nd, 2010. My brother's birthday,
great.
Actually. Yeah, it's great. It's been a great year. Lots of change going on in the world and in my world. And, and so it's been a beautiful, beautiful transition for sure.
And you have not always worked in retail. I met you with Tempranillo, which was a company that, you know, you gave your heart and soul to, as you're giving this new company your heart and soul to. So I was wondering about that transition for you.
Well, that was tough. I mean, I worked for that company, Tempranillo Inc. They're importers and distributors of fine estates from Spain. It's a collection of wines from Spain for nearly 7 years. And kind of grew me as the Spanish wine you know, person that I strive to be, you know, and work every day for. But it was amazing. It was an amazing ride.
Yeah.
Lots of experience, lots of exposure, lots of delicious wine that I was able to taste and learn about. And my passion is Spain first and foremost. The everything else came afterwards, but a great path and learning adventure.
I attribute Tempranillo to, you know, being in the industry for a while as well, to really setting off the Spanish wine craze in the city, which it seems you were very involved in. You know, it was something that, you know, now we have many more Spanish inspired restaurants and tapas bars to count on our hands. But back when, you know, 7 years ago, 6 years ago, even, they did not exist. So there was a wave of really an interest in Spanish wine. And I'm sure you have something to comment on as to the growth of that industry.
I mean, I remember when I first started, when I obviously didn't know as much. I mean, I started with Tempranillo when I was 24 years old. So I was also learning. I had spent a lot of time in Spain and had always worked in restaurants. But when I started working for the company, I had a lot of learning to do myself. But going out there to the market, which was, you know, mostly Manhattan restaurants, upscale, you know, all the way from Per Se, John George, or back then Per Se wasn't around, but John George and Oceana and all of these wonderful restaurants, Le Bernardin, trying to get a, you know, a Chacolí or a white Rioja on their list was, people didn't know what Chacolí was, let alone how to pronounce it.
Sure, and, sure.
Today, and actually there was only a few on the market back then, maybe 2-3 Chacolís that were even noticeable, or even if available. And now people come in the store, not only do they know how to say it, they know the grapes, they know different producers, they've been to the region, they're seeking it. People come in, do you have Chacolí? And now, you know, Tinto Fino at this moment is a little bit shy just because it's February, or January, excuse me. You know, in the summer we had up until to 10 or 11 different Chacolís, including a couple of rosés and a red. It's pretty amazing.
For a small store, that's fantastic.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah. I mean, if we're going to do Spain, we got to kind of do the best of and all of what we can get. But so the overall knowledge and interest and consumption of Spanish wine, wine in general, absolutely. But Spanish wine in particular has grown a lot.
That's neat. That's neat to look back on.
It's exciting.
Well, today we're going to do a little lesson in Rioja for our listeners. Please call in with any questions. Karen's going to walk us through a very popular region after this short break. You are listening to At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network, available on heritageradionetwork.com and via iPod podcast. And today my guest, Karen Auth, we've just wrapped up the previous segment talking a bit about the current state of Spanish wine and her store Tinto Fino and the great selection that it has, and wanted to segue into talking about your recent trip. I know you just returned back from Spain, and was it October?
We got back towards the third week in September.
Okay. And there's all these emerging wine regions. As Spanish wine has become more popular, there's more outlets for regions which are less heard of, less known, to make a mark. And one of those we were just speaking about during the break was Bierzo, with the grape Encia. Mm-hmm. Really being a standout wine that people, I think, are growingly interested in. What other regions are you seeing expansion of?
You know, we've been doing, and I wonder what the parallel to the flavor profile that it has to do with our consumer. But we are selling, and there's a lot of interest in the wines of the Levant region, which would encompass like Jumilla and Alicante, Valencia, all of those kind of southeastern Mediterranean areas.
Yeah. Do you think that those are more attractive to an American palate because they're more southern in Spain and the grapes are pretty ripe and very kind of more New World style in some ways?
I definitely think that there is a parallel there. I think that people can relate to the Monastrell, which is the classic varietal of the region, although they blend a lot of Syrah and a lot of Merlot and a lot of Cabernet Sauvignon, actually. So I think there's a familiarity there to people's palates and the concentration. I mean, within the region, there are some subtle wines and there are some interesting options to veer away from that. But the majority of them, due to their origin, are, you know, more high concentration in fruit, thicker, riper, denser wines, higher in alcohol, richer.
Yeah.
Overall, like winter style of wine.
Sure. Maybe good value, no?
And good value. There's a lot of, it's a quote-unquote new wine region, but it's mostly a lot of reasons why it took so long to emerge. But I think that people are paying attention, and so there's a lot of great wine coming out and for inexpensive prices. And a lot of, just paralleling it back to where we are here at Heritage Radio, there's a lot of organic wine coming out of the area in southern Spain due to their very dry climate, but they, temperature wise, it's super hot and they have great drainage and great soil. And so they're able to do a lot of things in a very natural way.
And what is the distinction on the label for any winemaker who is growing organically in Spain?
The designation.
Yeah.
There's two. I mean, that's actually a few. You can find things that will say things like agricultura ecológica, which is agricultural, ecological farming, basically. Then you'll have wines that will say things like made with organic grapes, which is, the farms, obviously, the vineyards don't see any any treatment, and they do all of the farming organic, but then perhaps the yeast or sulfurs that they're using in the winery are a little bit more wild. Yeah. And so they aren't able to label it as organic, but that the actual farming is done all naturally. And then you have, of course, the organic designation, which is the most difficult to come by just for a lot of wineries, mostly because of the time period you need to be certified organic. I bet you'll start seeing more and more movement now that people realize it's important. I think the rule is seven years, it could be 10, of completely certified organic farming before you're allowed to stamp it organic. Mm-hmm. So as you know, that costs money in sure. a lot of places. We do organic farming, but to get the certification, it's not as important to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had also noted in a previous show that a lot of the wines that we drink are probably more often than not farmed that way, even though we don't know that they are, you know, and I'd imagine the same being true in Spain.
Well, they like using, well, first of all, it's free.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more difficult and it takes more knowledge and more research, but, you know, a lot of times they'll use things like, you know, natural product, manure, and different products from the actual vineyards themselves or secondary byproducts in mm-hmm. order to control the vineyards. So it takes more to do the research to figure out how to do it correctly. But in the long run, it's a much more sustainable type of farming.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm sure we could cover this topic in more depth, but I wanted to also bring back Rioja into discussion. There was an article not too long ago published in the New York Times by Asimov, and I recall it getting quite a bit of attention as it did speak about Rioja's 360 in terms of its past to its present and the popularity of it, and how, as you're writing with a Rioja pen.
I have to also shout out, I think this is a wonderful opportunity to the Vibrant Rioja campaign, actually. I didn't even plan that, Erin. I swear, I did not. That's a pure chance. But they, Vibrant Rioja has a wonderful campaign that's been using Rioja as an outlet to introduce people and to really grow the consumption and the knowledge and the awareness of the wines of Rioja and how beautiful and amazing they are. And they do some great promotional events, and you can check out their website as well, Vibrant Rioja. But they did some promotional things in our store and left these pens. Not only are they beautiful and say Vibrant Rioja, but they're one of the best pens I've ever written with. I don't leave home without one now at this point. I'll take more if they're listening, actually.
Well, we have time to do a Rioja 101, and segueing from that article, which did speak about the difference between the styles of Rioja being a little bit more modern to using American oak and French oak, and I know a lot of people like Rioja. They call it, they're coming to your store for it, but let's give it a, can you give us a grasp as to how to define it?
A little Rioja 101. Yeah. Okay, so I mean, the first coolest fact about Rioja, for people that don't know, and for those that do, sorry for the elementariness of it, but it's a really cool, fun fact. I love it. That a lot of people say, oh, you know, white wine, rosé. There's a lot of things that come out of the region of Rioja, which is what it is. It's a region, a classified denominación de origen calificada, one of two of the highest classifications of Spanish wine, in Spain. And they do, it's Rioja and Priorat, actually, is the other, the second. It became a DOC in 1991. It was the first, one of the first regions to actually get classification in general, but the first to become this secondary, this highest level of classification, which is the Calificada. And but the name Rioja actually comes from a river that runs through Rioja. And so the word river in Spanish is Rio, and then the name of that river is Oja. So there's a river that runs all through, the river runs through it, and it's called Rio Oja. So Rioja actually got its name from there. It's confusing because sometimes people think of red wine, and Rojo is red. And so one of the basic things I always say is that they make fantastic white wine. They make beautiful mm-hmm. rosés. And they actually are one of the seven regions that's allowed to make cava, sparkling wine. They share the same varietal, which is the Macabeo, white grape, mm-hmm. as to the Viura grape of Rioja is the same white varietal. So they're able to make cava, one of my favorite.
Do you see that much?
You don't see it much. Yeah. Right now in the States, I see one. It's one of my favorite Rioja producers, Muga. They make a beautiful classic style of cava labeled. Actually, it's interesting because it says Dio Cava, but it's from Rioja. But you'll see at the bottom, it says, first of it says Bodegas Muga, and then it'll say Aro. And Aro is kind of like the capital of Rioja Alta. And so you'll know it's from Rioja. They're allowed to make it as long as they use the exact method tradicional, and then they do it with the cava grape, the macabeo in this case. Yeah, very cool. So that's one of the first things I think is interesting, that there's a huge spectrum of flavor and color in Rioja that a lot of people don't know about when they may think of the classic tinto red wine. And as far as the grape varietals, people come in often also. One of the things that I see a lot is, you know, most wine, there's some new laws that have kind of changed it a little bit, but the foundation of Rioja is based on the grape Tempranillo. It's a native grape to the region. You see it in several other areas, like in Ribera del Duero, in the Toro region. You also see it in the south in La Mancha.
Where it has quite a different expression.
Totally different expression. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people talk about clones and different little, you know, cloning of the Tempranillo grape. But, you know, the soil and the climate and the other conditions, you know, moisture, runoff, you know, is it continental? Is it Atlantic climate? Is it Mediterranean? You know, all takes different faces. Mm-hmm. You know? It's like people from New York and people from Florida. We're all people. We just act a little different. But yeah, I mean, Tempranillo from Rioja, as you were saying before, Rioja's in general. Back to Eric Asimov's article.
Yeah, let's touch base on that. I'd love to talk about that.
So I'm sorry to ask this question. Are you speaking of the one that he wrote about where Lopez de Heredia was the theme, basically? Mm-hmm. So yeah, he did this beautiful article about, like, I guess a winery that stood the test of time or is like a glimpse in Rioja's past, about speaking of Rioja. And there are several different styles. And Tempranillo to me and Rioja in general is like, to me, you know, running an all Spanish wine shop, people come in with what they normally drink. Oh, it's only Spanish wine, but I usually drink Pinot Noir, or I really enjoy, you know, classic Brunello. And you have to kind of take, you know, Rioja and bring it to a place where people can understand. And I feel like Tempranillo, especially when it comes from Rioja, is one of the most versatile wines of Spain and maybe of the world, just in its ability to be soft and traditional, and by when I say traditional, I mean, you know, softer in color, more amber, light, more rustic on the palate, just a little bit more delicate, barnyardy, you know, things like that, as opposed to the more new style of Rioja, entre comillas, in quotes, because, you know, it's mostly about the education process that's come into their site and their ability to make better, cleaner wine. So new, modern, all those things. I kind of try to stay away from a lot of that classification.
Yeah.
You can get into it and it's easy. I mean, the one that we're sipping now, which we'll talk about in a second, is definitely kind of on the fence, I find. It's not new, it's not old, it's rich, it's Tempranillo for sure. It has those cherry, malted chocolates, tobacco, pipe aromatics. But
in a blind tasting, I'd say that this would be harder to pick up.
Fun.
As something like a Lopez de Heredia or...
Well, you know, exactly. So yeah. Lopez de Heredia is probably, you know, they started making wine, I believe, their first vintage, or they founded it in 1877. It's been run by the family ever since. And there it's like a winery stopped in time. We actually did a piece in the shop at Tinto Fino about it. And those wines are classic. I mean, there's mold growing off the walls there. We went there on our recent trip, and I mean, there is live penicillin growing on the walls. They clean it every year, but the natural conditions of the winery are that of just pure aging, pure, you know, a moment in time. They use all oak. They have their own cooperage. It's this just beautiful, beautiful classic winery.
And if I'm not mistaken, the article was also kind of demonstrating a return to that style, a return to more interest in that style, as opposed to, even though as great as, you know, Lanzaga from Tomo Rodriguez may be, and it certainly fits a profile of Rioja, it is quite different from that classic style.
It's true, and it's a great point. you mentioned before that I had worked for the portfolio of Tempranillo and Jorge Ordóñez, and we represent the Lanzaga from Telmo Rodriguez for quite some time, and Ramirez de Ganusa and Muga, Sierra Cantabria, all of these just fantastic Riojas. I mean, that's the portfolio for a fantastic Rioja wine. But and you know, there is definitely, there was a trend, a really fast, super, I don't know if it was market driven, if it was media driven, if it was Robert Parker driven, but there was a very fast trend to create these wines that are incredibly concentrated and new French oak, high toast, high alcohol, high tannin. And those wines were the ones that were being reviewed positively. And you were getting a lot of action online and in all of these places, high scores. And people were really racing for these wines for their cellars. And I watched it over the past eight years. And there's definitely a return to those more friendly, lower in alcohol. When I drink Rioja, I don't necessarily want 15% alcohol. I want 13.5, like the one that we're having right now, which is...
Please,
actually, it's really delicious. And we just got a couple cases today at the shop, and so I grabbed it because I hadn't tried the 04 vintage yet, which is just a stunning vintage in Rioja. This one is called Barón de Ley, and we're doing a 2004 Reserva. And I actually finished my glass. I wish I could reach the bottle from here so I could give you a fresh tasting note. It's lovely. I mean, obviously, it's mostly Tempranillo.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of went into it not knowing anything, and I wanted to see if I mean, knowing a few things about the winery, but there's obviously a blend of French and American oak, I think, just from the palate. They're using mostly Tempranillo, and I believe they blend a little bit of Garnacha in this wine. I can kind of taste a little bit of a juicier quality. But what we were talking about before, that old school, new school, this wine just falls so beautifully, I think, in between. It's got the concentration of a more modern style, more richer wine, 2004.
Yeah, very likable. Yeah.
Very likable, very friendly. Mm-hmm. Back to that Pinot Noir, you know, type style of wine where you're food friendly, versatile friendly, like a group of people. One person drinks Merlot, one person drinks Pinot Noir, one person drinks California Cab. I think that Tempranillo always seems to be able, especially in this style of Rioja, is always able to please a lot of palates. Mm-hmm. For sure.
Well, I know that we have to wrap up. We have another show coming on the network, but I'd love for you to come back. This has just been too fast. And I know you have so much more to share, so hopefully you'll join us again.
I would love to. This is great.
I'm super excited. Our listeners, what's your website of Tintofino?
So the website is www.tintofino.com. We are located at 85 First Avenue between 5th and 6th Streets. We also do wine tastings every Wednesday from 5 to 8 and every Saturday from 4 to 7. So you can stop by and taste a little bit and learn more for yourself.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Erin.
Okay.
Next Adios. Time.
And thank you to our producer and engineer, Jack Inslee, and Nat Wiener, and to our sponsor, Whole Foods Market. Look forward to having you again next week, 4 p.m. Tuesday.
So good.